Welcome to KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's December 19th of 2022. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Coming up on today's program, we'll hear what came out of a series of meetings held last week to update air quality standards along the Front Range. And CityCast Denver dives into the legacy and legal battles of a reclusive local billionaire who built a business empire out of pizza cheese. At the bottom of the hour, we'll hear the BBC News headlines and then the Hightower Lowdown. After that, it's Good Ol' CU with Joe Uhas. Then at 9 a.m., we'll bring you Counterspin, a look at fairness and accuracy in reporting. After that, Carrie Wolfson will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead this morning, but first, these headlines with KGNU's Stacey Johnson.
Fire crews responded early Sunday morning to reports of an explosion along the Poudre River bike trail near Fort Collins between Shield Street and South Taft Hill Road. The Poudre Fire Authority said they were able to quickly extinguish the fire that was in a cottonwood stand while also assisting one individual with an unknown medical condition. Poudre Fire has released no further information on the incident and says the cause of the blaze is under investigation. Denver's Housing Stability Office hosted a panel discussion Friday covering the city's efforts to provide services while also conducting a homeless advisory meeting where unhoused community members could raise their concerns and requests. Among the panelists were officials from governmental offices and nonprofits, including the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless, Urban Peak Denver, and Mile High United Way. Britta Fisher from the Denver's Housing Stability Office says the city in the last 3 years has helped 5,000 households regain stable housing while also building affordable homes and housing units with supportive services. Fisher also noted that the city now operates shelters 24/7 rather than just at night. Other panelists noted improvements in data collection, resources from the American Rescue Plan Act, and integration of housing and health. Several unhoused community members raised concerns about homeless camp sweeps and their struggles during freezing weather after the city throws away their belongings. Colorado's community colleges more than doubled their graduation rates by better supporting students. KGNU's Benita Lee has more.
Colorado's community colleges increased their graduation rates from 15% to 31% between 2015 and 2020. This according to a report released by nonprofit Complete College America, an organization that encourages states and college systems to improve graduation rates. Colorado education officials say several changes helped streamline the path towards a degree. These include offering free tutoring or extra class time to students enrolled in courses for credit toward their graduation. This saves students money that otherwise might be lost to non-credit remedial courses. The college system now also focuses on meeting students' basic needs by offering food pantries and help with housing. However, since the pandemic, more students of color are choosing not to spend money on college. This shift concerns Colorado educators who don't want Black and Latino students to lose ground gained in recent years. For KGNU, I'm Benita Lee.
Faculty leaders throughout the University of Colorado system are asking the university's leadership and the CU Board of Regents why CU did not withdraw investment gains that were earmarked for projects at the system's four campuses. The university has lost nearly $120 million in stock market downturns that it earmarked for projects nearly a year ago. According to the Denver Post, CU President Todd Solomon blamed the financial misstep on a now-resigned system treasurer, Tony Vu. CU faculty say the financial loss is felt system-wide, and they are seeing programs halted, reinstated, or campus leadership using funds earmarked for other needs. Salomon says the university plans on hiring a third-party expert to help evaluate what went wrong and to ensure an investment mishap does not happen again. The city of Boulder says its community-wide greenhouse gas emissions have fallen by more than 15% in the last 5 years. This, according to a 2021 greenhouse gas inventory report the city released last week. The city's climate targets against a 2018 baseline are to reduce emissions by 70% to 2030 and becoming a net zero city by 2035. The 2021 emissions snapshot from the report says the biggest contributors to emissions come from building electrical use at 38%, on-road transportation fuels at 27%, building natural gas use at 23%, and aviation at 10%. Broomfield officials and the nonprofit Solar United Neighbors have announced they are launching a solar co-op to help the community's residents and small businesses acquire and use solar energy. The Daily Camera reports the solar co-op will aim to inform members about solar energy and will also help and solicit proposals from solar companies for members to vote on and choose to do their solar installation. As part of the Federal Inflation Reduction Act, co-op members will also have an opportunity to take advantage of a 30% rooftop solar tax credit. Broomfield officials say the co-op is free to join and is open to homeowners and business owners in Broomfield. For today's weather, the National Weather Service says skies will be mostly sunny with highs in the low to mid-40s. Winds could gust as high as 33 miles per hour. Tonight will be mostly cloudy with calmer winds and a low of 14 for Fort Collins and 19 for Denver and Boulder. For KGNU, I'm Stacy Johnson.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Colorado's Air Quality Control Commission held a series of meetings last week to discuss air quality plans for the near future. This comes as the Environmental Protection Agency has signaled that air quality across much of the Front Range is not in compliance with standards set forth in the Clean Air Act. Joining me to answer the question as to what now, Executive Director of Colorado Communities for Climate Action, Jacob Smith. Thanks for coming on the program.
Oh, you bet. Thanks for having me.
So the state's appointed Air Quality Control Commission met last week to set standards for air quality. What exactly came out of those meetings?
Well, not a whole lot. They acknowledged that they are still facing enormous problems and the solutions they've crafted so far have been inadequate. They have made some commitments to, once again, to try and do a better job on those. It remains to be seen whether they'll follow through or not, but at least they seem to be acknowledging that the approaches they've been taking so far are inadequate and it's time to step up their game.
Well, aside from just acknowledging that it's been inadequate, I mean, like, what concrete measures are they taking to step up their game?
Yeah, and it's not a whole lot. They have committed to launching a stakeholder process that will look at revising the plan that they just adopted because they have acknowledged the plan is inadequate. They are going to look at some specific potential ozone control measures, and that's meaningful because they've at least identified some specific measures they're going to look at, but it's as tepid as it sounds like, because they had a chance to adopt some really strong steps to reduce ozone pollution, and they didn't take those. So I'd say it's a mixed bag. At least they are committing in a very clear way to look at some of these additional steps, but they should have adopted some.
And with these meetings, we're talking about two different governmental bodies here. We have the state's Air Pollution Control Division and the Air Quality Control Commission. What's the differences between the two bodies, and what do they do when it comes to air quality?
Sure. Well, the Air Pollution Control Division, which is also referred to as the APCD, is an actual agency, part of the state government, and they're the agency that does all of the analysis and the work, and they write the proposals, and they bring them then to this body called the Air Quality Control Commission, which is also known as the AQCC. That's the appointed body, and they're the ones that actually make decisions about new rules. So they're connected but different. And the APCD, the actual state agency, their challenge now is to come up with some really clear ozone control steps and then bring them back to the Air Quality Control Commission, which ultimately will make these decisions.
Well, when it comes to coming up with concrete steps, Colorado Communities for Climate Action, of which you are the executive director, has members who are local government officials. And these local officials have already come up with a list of actionable measures to reduce air pollution. What are some of those measures, and were any included in this new plan?
Sure. The Colorado Communities for Climate Action, as you said, it's a coalition of local governments, 40 local governments, counties and towns and cities across the state. And we've been very involved in this issue for a long time now, because it's has such an impact on health and on climate pollution, greenhouse gas emissions. We've been proposing that they consider a whole bunch of options, all of which could have a really big impact on ozone pollution. Some examples, one would be a really good example, is the oil and gas industry right now, during the peak ozone season, which is basically the summer, continues to participate in activities that are hugely high emission activities. We know that these specific activities are referred to as pre-production for oil and gas drilling, result in huge ozone pollution or emissions of the precursors of the pollutants that become ozone. And if they were to just pause that during just the peak season, that would make a huge difference. Or at a minimum, use equipment that would reduce or eliminate those emissions so that we don't end up during peak season with this a whole bunch of additional ozone pollution that we shouldn't have and don't need. That's one good example. Another would be, Suncor is a great example, where they do a lot of flaring, where they basically burn the gases that then result ultimately in the precursors in the air, which are the pollutants that become ozone. If they had a better job of controlling that flaring, that would make a big difference, but they won't unless they're required to. We know that small off-road, often referred to as small off-road engines, like lawnmowers, like heavy lawn equipment, are a major source of the pollutants that become ozone. So taking more assertive steps to help transition to electric powered lawnmowers and snowblowers and so on would make a huge difference.
And you mentioned Suncor, and which kind of seems like the elephant in the room here. Why has it been so difficult to place any kind of meaningful restrictions on the activities of Suncor?
Well, I would say, first of all, I would say that I don't think they're the elephant in the room. I think they are a major player and obviously a major polluter, but they're not alone. There are a whole bunch of other oil and gas industry, more generally, a bunch of operators that are doing things that result in these pollutants emitted into the air. So it doesn't reduce to Suncor, but they are a big player. And the state has made some real progress over in recent years at reining in some of their pollution, but they still have a long way to go. It is a major source of pollution of all kinds, toxic pollution and the kinds of pollution that result in these health problems and greenhouse gas emissions through ozone pollution. And they're a big company with a lot of political power, and it can be hard to force companies like that to scale back on their pollution.
My guest today has been Jacob Smith, Executive Director of Colorado Communities for Climate Action. Thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. We'll be right back. Did you know most cheese served on U.S. pizzas is supplied by the Denver-based company Leprino Foods? It's controlled by one man, the reclusive billionaire James Jim Leprino. But that's pretty much all we knew about Leprino until recently, when his nieces took him to court and forced the family's billion-dollar succession drama into the public record. CityCast Denver producer Paul Caroli sat down with Westward reporter Helen Hsu, also known as Helen X, who was in the courtroom to share previously unknown details about how Leprino cornered the mozzarella market and the inner workings of one of Denver's most fascinating and secretive companies.
So Helen, we have to start with the man at the center of this whole story. Who is James Leprino?
James Leprino is this fascinating character in Denver, and I really feel like most people have never heard of him. Maybe they've heard of Leprino Foods, but they probably don't know anything about the family behind it. But James Leprino, he is the son of immigrants, and he is the son of immigrants who started a small Italian grocery store in Denver's Little Italy. And when it ended up having to fold because a larger grocery chain was moving into town, he had already started to get the idea of cheese being a moneymaker. He was looking around and all these pizzerias were popping up. He was noticing how popular pizza was. with the neighborhood kids. And so in 1958, he started the Prino Foods Company with, I think Forbes reported, $615 in his pocket. So a really American dream story.
Wow.
So with almost nothing, you know, just being scrappy and entrepreneurial, he has a very good business sense. You know, he's been able to grow La Prino Foods into a multi-billion dollar company that today provides 85% of the world's pizza cheese. He's the exclusive provider to Pizza Hut, Domino's, Papa John's. His cheese is on a ton of frozen meals like Stouffer's and Marie Callender meals. And there's a very, very high chance that you have consumed a lot of La Prino food cheese mozzarella, and you've just never known about it. And it's a private company headquartered in Denver. It's still family owned. It's this crazy American dream story of a son of immigrants rising to be, you know, one of the top billionaires in America.
It really is an incredible story. Why don't we know about it?
They're extremely private. They're a private company, so that already allows them a bit of a shield from the public, right? They don't have to report out on financials. They don't have thousands of shareholders. They don't have huge investor firms bugging them about their finances and performance. And then I think personally, the family has just been very private. Before this trial started, there was only one publicly available photo of James G.
From 1987.
Yes. I think he's like 38 or something. I forget how old he is in that photo, but it's been a long time. And there's only one interview with him on record, which is this 2017 Forbes article. And I have no idea how they convinced him to do it. I think even in the article, he's quoted saying something like, "I can't believe I agreed to this. I don't want to do this."
So before we get into the trial, which has really given us our first proper look into the company and into the family dynamics behind it, can you just explain, how did he corner the market on this specific type of low quality, low cost mozzarella cheese from Denver?
I think it's a combination of, in the beginning, he was willing to serve that low cost market, right? So the same year he founded La Prino Foods, that's when Pizza Hut was founded. I think Little Caesars was started maybe a year afterwards. Domino's started delivering pizza around that time. So he was in at the right time at the very beginning. And what all those chains needed at that moment was low-cost, reliable mozzarella cheese. Cheese is one of the biggest cost drivers of a pizza. He was able to step into that space and provide them something that's consistent, that's reliable, and also low cost. And the way he was able to do that is really leveraging a lot of technology, right? Like, he was not one of these artisan crafters of mozzarella cheese from the old world. He didn't really care about that history and culture. He was like, give me all the additives, give me all the chemicals. You know, he hired a lot of food scientists and engineers to really figure out how to make a consistent product that tasted good enough, but more importantly, just was consistent and reliable. I don't think they've ever had a recall. Up to today, La Prino Foods has never had a recall for cheese, which cheese is a very, very bacteria vulnerable product. So that's kind of an amazing success story in itself. And then he's a great businessman. From what I'm reading is that he was able to really develop these personal relationships with all these huge pizza chains. You know, there's a paragraph in this Forbes article that says when Domino's entered into an exclusive supplier relationship with La Prino, it was a one-page contract. Can you even imagine these days, right? It was very much like a trust.
To Domino's.
Yes. And
wow.
Admittedly, you know, this is back in the 80s and 70s. Business was done a little bit more old boys club, but he was able to establish these great relationships. He was able to constantly deliver. He was able to constantly evolve the technology of his cheese making to serve their needs best. So, you know, he has 50 patents or something like that. There's just a ton of stuff that they've done in the food science of developing cheese. They reduce the aging process to 4 hours. So they can take milk in to the factory and then produce mozzarella cheese in less than 4 hours. All of that combined with, as he got more and more successful, he invested in a lot of expansion. So they have a 100-acre factory in Greeley, Colorado. And at that scale, that means that you can produce so much more at low cost, meaning you can capture such a bigger margin, offer the lower prices to your customers. And so I think all of these factors is just kind of contributed to him like dominating the pizza cheese market.
So we knew he was very successful. We knew this was a private company and we knew he was very reclusive, but we didn't really know very much about the inner workings of the company or the family. This is still a family company at the end of the day. Until this trial, the whole Loprieno family was fighting over his fortune, over his company. Can you explain why the Loprieno family was in court this month?
This goes back to 1965. So Loprieno Foods was founded in 1958. So this is about 7 years afterwards. And Jim Loprieno had his cheese company, and his older brother, Michael Jr. Loprieno, was an independently successful businessman. He was in commercial real estate. He was in banking. And the story that I have been told by the lawyers is that their parents sat them down and they were honestly concerned about Jim and his prospects, right? Like, you run a cheese company, It's going okay, but we're concerned about your financial stability and prospects. And so they asked the two brothers to exchange 25% of each other's business with each other. And very much kind of, in my feeling, it's a very old Italian, you know, you take care of the family. And that deal obviously ended up benefiting Michael Jr.'s family a lot more than it benefited Jim Loprieno's family, because Loprieno Foods went on to become a multi-billion dollar company. And so there's always been this kind of split in ownership at the company. Majority shareholders are Jim Loprieno, and then eventually he sold a lot of his shares to his two daughters. And then Michael Jr.'s side of the family, same thing happened. He owns 25% and eventually sold it into trust, or passed it into trust, for his three daughters. Jim's side of the family is very active in the business. Jim's made it no secret that he wants them to succeed him. He wants them to take over the company. And on the other side, it's a little bit more passive. They don't hold active positions in the company. They have independent careers or independent lives.
So tell me about the case itself, Helen. What are these nieces suing Loprieno over?
If I was to ask the lawyers, they would say this case is about a breach in fiduciary duty. And there was two breaches that they alleged. Probably the most people paid attention to and was a big focus of the trial was in 2017, Jim and the majority shareholders voted to convert the company from an S corporation to a C corporation. Now, only the majority shareholders voted on that. And what happens when you do a conversion is that all of the profits that were made under the S corporation are required to be distributed to the shareholders. So in this case, Jim and his family got $405 million, and then his nieces got $90 million, a ton of money. But almost 3 days after that $405 million hit the Jim Loprieno's family's bank account, they turned around and they loaned it back to the company for 2.68% interest. And so they're able to make now a yearly cash flow off of this one-time disbursement that they loan back. They're able to make millions and millions of dollars of cash flow every single year, where the nieces got their one-time $90 million payout, and they did not get the opportunity to loan it back to the company. And the company has made it part of their bylines that they do not give dividends to their shareholders. So in a way, this $90 million payout is kind of the last payout these nieces will ever see, theoretically.
So how did the trial play out in the end?
So the jury ruled in favor of the defendants, so in favor of Loprieno Foods Company, Jim Loprieno, and his immediate family. And they did not award the nieces any amount of settlement. They were asking anywhere from $600 to $900 million, and that would have been the responsibility of the jury to decide how much. Hmm.
Well, Helen, now that the trial is settled, I assume Mr. Loprieno will go back to wherever it is he does, wherever he lives, wherever he goes. He's 84 years old. He's not going to be able to run this company forever. Is there any reason to think that Denver will at some point lose its place as the capital of low-cost, low-quality pizza cheese?
I honestly don't think so. He set up this company to be successful for at least another generation, if not more. All of the infrastructure that they've built is going to last, you know, for the next generation or two. And a lot of their scientific breakthroughs and food science breakthroughs. I mean, that's really become their unique value proposition, and that's not going away anytime soon. I honestly think we'll see his grandchildren, you know, in the same position, dominating the pizza cheese market. Maybe they'll increase from 85% to 100%. There's been a lot of churn in the cheese industry lately, and I think they're fully set up.
Well, Helen X, thanks so much for joining me on CityCast Denver.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This was awesome to talk about.
You just heard an excerpt from CityCast Denver, the local Denver daily news podcast. Learn more about subscribing to the podcast at denver.citycast.fm or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Shannon Young. Special thanks to Stacey Johnson, Benita Lee, Alexis Kenyon, and the CityCast Denver crew for their contributions to today's program. If you'd like to comment on something you heard on KGNU, you can leave us a voicemail at 303-447-9911. We play the messages back on Tuesdays during the Morning Magazine. Stay tuned for a commentary from Jim Hightower, and then good old CU with Joe Juhasz. That's coming up after the news headlines from the BBC.